The government has clearly lost control of the economy.
We are looking at a Conservative majority of 86.
Why is the Prime Minister making a bad situation worse for working people by hammering them with a cut to universal credit and a tax rise?
I actually think that this is a win-win. It's an open goal for Liz Truss, really.
Will you shut up, man?
You said it on the record. You said you want to return.
And just to come in on something that you, Ed Miliband.
Order!
Bringing you the stories behind the headlines. You're listening to Politics Unboxed. Absolutely, you are listening to Politics Unboxed. Hello, welcome back. It is 2 minutes past two on this very fine Wednesday, the 30th of November, and you're listening to the 1400 Show on Expression FM, brought to you by Politics Unboxed and presented by me. I'm Maurice Wallace, I'm the head of station here at Expression FM, and I'm back behind the microphone, and boy, does it feel good. It's going to be a packed show for you today. We've got plenty to talk about, whether it is that new potential miracle drug. Is it Turkey on the brink of sparking an international crisis? You don't know. Maybe they are. Buckingham Palace aide resigns. We'll be talking about Prime Minister's questions as part-time Paul gets a question. And we will have plenty more stories to talk about. Well, 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 hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Politics Unboxed. This is just gone 2 p.m. here on Expression FM, and we have a lot to get through today. First off, though, we're going to start with a story which I can't really pronounce. Yecanemab. That'll do. Yecanemab. Yecanemab. It is a historic moment, according to Susan Colas, who is the Director of Research at Alzheimer's Research UK, because it is the first real drug that has been able to show a reversal, or not quite a reversal, but a slowing down of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's patients. So this is a real breakthrough. It is a drug that has been worked on and hoped for and, well, wanted for quite a while. And now we've seen from a study in small trials, and it has shown that the destruction of the brain caused by Alzheimer's can now be slowed down. So this is a real breakthrough in something that is a really, really important, really, really important breakthrough for medical professionals and practitioners. And in fact, I've been pronouncing the drug wrong. It's lecanemab, not yecanemab. So here's how this works. Lecanemab attacks sort of a sticky gunge, which is called the beta amyloid, which builds up in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. So this new drug, which has an antibody, so a bit like the vaccines that inject a little bit of sort of learning behaviour, this is just what would happen after that learning behaviour. There's an antibody which can bind to an antigen on this amyloid protein, this beta amyloid, which sort of sticks up in the brain of a person with Alzheimer's. These antibodies then bind to the amyloid protein and attract immune cells to break down the protein. This means that there are fewer bits of that beta amyloid around that neuron, so those little connections within your brain, and it means that the progression of Alzheimer's is actually reduced. It's a slowed down, let's say, destruction of the brain. Now, let's put a couple of caveats on this. There are a couple of leading researchers who are sort of delighted with this breakthrough. One, Professor John Hardy, said, well, he was worried this day was never going to come. But it has now turned up. So let's talk about some of the little asterisks just before we go and really talk about how we could see this moving forward. So, lecanemab is really, it's really experimental at the moment. There's been a very small study, and it only seems to have a small effect. So the impact on daily life for people who would take lecanemab would be debatable. But having said that, it is still a momentous first for the industry, for the field, and something that we should be looking at and thinking, well, how can we first off test it and then make sure that it can get to people? So this drug could be used to sort of ameliorate some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's. So obviously people are probably familiar with memory lapses as a symptom of Alzheimer's. Things like asking questions over and over again, forgetting conversations, struggling with names, things like that. But it also, because it's changing your brain, can alter mood. So it can make people more anxious, agitated. And as things deteriorate, symptoms get progressively worse and more sort of wide-ranging in their effects. So you can lead to disturbed sleep, mood swings, hallucinations, confusion, disorientation, and even delusions. And by sort of the culmination of this disease, people can need help with really simple tasks. So eating and just getting dressed, which normally leads to those suffering with Alzheimer's, especially in its advanced cases, needing full-time care. Now, this drug, again, we don't yet have a drug that can reverse Alzheimer's. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a drug that will slow down the destruction of the brain caused by Alzheimer's. But it is very expensive. So lecanemab is an expensive drug to manufacture, and all of these companies manufacturing it are private companies. There is also no competition to drive down any price. And companies will want to sort of cover their losses in terms of all the money spent researching it and developing it. So according to James Gallagher, who is the health and science correspondent at the BBC, the best guess on what a price for this drug could be is to look at something called, aducanumab, which is a similar drug and people also hoped would work in cases of Alzheimer's. That costs $28,000 for a year's supply in the United States. Now, we would hope for that to be able to be mitigated slightly by our vastly different public health system in the United Kingdom. But given that we would be purchasing this as a nation on an open market, an international market at that, the initial cost to the NHS would be similar. But that is just the cost of the drug. Lecanemab still needs to go through tests. It needs to go through more and more trials. It needs to be approved for wider use. So we're looking at a bit of a time lag here before we see lecanemab into the market. But also, that $28,000 is just the cost of sort of buying the drug. It's not anything to do with going to a doctor's surgery to have it prescribed or administered, which costs money in America in forms of things like a copay. It also doesn't cover any of the sort of myriad tests you would probably need in order to be actually given this drug on the medical professional recommendation. So this is very, very early on. It's very early on in the process, and we will be hoping, obviously, that this is a big breakthrough, a really good breakthrough, and I think a lot of people We know that there are more than 55 million people affected by Alzheimer's around the world. Alzheimer's being the most common form of dementia. They are slightly different things. Dementia is all about the symptoms. That's just a general term to describe where someone's memory and thinking skills can decline. But Alzheimer's disease is that very specific buildup of those toxic proteins that I was talking about. Remember those beta amyloids? They eventually then destroy the brain cells and lead to the symptoms of dementia. But there will be millions and millions of people around the world crossing their fingers and really hoping that this will be the breakthrough that people have been hoping for. So, let's have a look at some of the other stories that we are going to be covering today. We're going to be having a look at a member of the royal household who has stepped down over remarks at a reception hosted by the Queen Consort. We'll be talking HSBC, as they are lining up 114 branches to close. The Eurostar is going on strike. Yep, not the trains, but the staff. We'll be talking about how members of the RMT union are going to be walking out for 4 days in the run-up to December 25th and the wider RMT strikes. And we'll also talk internationally, as at least 10 students have been killed after an explosion at a religious school in northern Afghanistan. Also, we'll be talking about issues a little closer to home, because in a video on Twitter, Nigel Farage has claimed that new census figures show that London, Birmingham and Manchester are now minority white cities. He's wrong, but let's have a look at why he's making those claims and have a look at the wider census data. Because whilst we are still a majority white country, and London, Manchester and Birmingham all saying that they are at least identifying at least 49% white ethnic group, there are some interesting figures to have a look at from the census data from 2021 from the ONS, because it's specifically around religion, which I think is a really important one to have a look at. And then we will, of course, have a discussion and an inquiry about the performance at Prime Minister's Questions by both Sir Keir Starmer, the Leader of the Opposition, and the Prime Minister. It was an interesting one, wasn't it? I wasn't a particular fan of Keir Starmer's performance at Prime Minister's Questions. He's sort of giving a few sort of softballs to Rishi Sunak, which he sort of gleefully smacked out of the park in terms of to his to his backbencher's glee. But here we go. It's going to be an interesting analysis, because Rishi Sunak leaning on a conservative record that should probably be under more scrutiny than it is. But let's talk first about something objectively very good, because the World Cup is on right now, as people will be, I'm sure, aware, in Qatar, with games kicking off at 3 o'clock today, our time, UK time. Australia versus Denmark and Tunisia versus France, some final round matches in Group C. And then Poland v Argentina and Saudi Arabia versus Mexico at 7 p.m, those final round matches in Group D. Oh, no, sorry, I've got the groups wrong way around. Group D is Australia, Denmark, Tunisia and France. Group C is Poland, Argentina, Saudi Arabia and Mexico. All to play for in that second group, by the way. But yesterday, there was a wonderful result for England and a poorer result for Wales. We saw, or I'm not sure whether you saw, I certainly saw, The England results. Great game. England 3, Wales 0. Marcus Rashford scoring twice. Phil Foden scoring in between those two Rashford goals. One of them a very well taken free kick. And England are through. England are through top of the group. Top of Group B, the USA beating Iran in the other match to go through in second place. Which means Iran and Wales out of the World Cup. Wales, after having made it through to their first World Cup since, I believe it was 1954? Maybe 1958? Quite a while, anyway. I think maybe 1958. I think I'm right on that one. Yes, first World Cup since 1958. It's not been a brilliant World Cup for Wales. One goal scored. Many more than that conceded. I think, what is it, 6 goals conceded for Wales. And bottom of the group, that 2-0 loss to Iran, really important and sort of gutting for that Wales side. But England sort of putting that free kick past Danny Ward after 50 minutes. Phil Foden turning in Harry Kane's cross a minute later, and then Rashford scoring his second of the match in the 68th minute. Ward not doing his best to save that second Rashford shot, but I mean, I think people really realistically knew it was sort of all over by that point. But England are through. There we go. After what was a very poor sort of warm-up period to the World Cup for an English point of view, we now see England through, top of the group. And they will play Senegal, who secured second place in Group A with victory over Ecuador. 2-1. Ismaila Sarr with a 44th minute no-look penalty. Coolness personified from the Senegalese star. Before Moses Caicedo scored an equaliser for Ecuador in the 67th minute. And just 3 minutes later, Kalidou Koulibaly with a very calm volley sent Senegal into the World Cup knockout stages for just the second time in their history. And this all happening without Sadio Mane. So, let's have a look and see what's coming up later today. Obviously, I've told you that Poland and Argentina will be playing. That's on the BBC. And Saudi Arabia and Mexico, both on the BBC at 7 o'clock today. And also on the BBC at 3 o'clock today, it's Australia, Denmark and Tunisia versus France. So I've got an idea. Here's what you can do. Put on the telly for those pictures. Leave the sound on this. Leave the sound on the radio on Expression FM, and I think we can have some fun. I'll talk you through the biggest political stories of the week, of the day, of however long it's going to be, and then you can still have some football on as well. How does that sound? Right, in sort of recognition of the football, let's play a song. And I think everybody knows which song I'm going to play, so I don't even really need to be very sort of casual about it. There's no real big segue coming here, because football itself is coming home. We'll see you on the other side. World in Motion, New Order and the England squad of Italia 90, if memory serves me well. Before that, of course, the Lightning Seeds, Skinner and Badil with Three Lions. I think it's safe to say World Cup fever is in full sway. Despite the egregious sort of accusations and scandals going on in Qatar, there hasn't been much of a boycott, certainly amongst England fans. And I don't know, it's always very hard in sort of sports. It's like when an artist or a songwriter has a particular scandal. Do you separate the art from the artist? Do you separate the footballing world from the political one? That's an interesting question for people to have a think about. And I don't know whether it has a particularly tidy answer. Something that also didn't get some very tidy answers was the display at Prime Minister's Question Time, where Keir Starmer was on his feet calling on Rishi Sunak to end the scandal of private school tax breaks. Let's have a little
listen. He's levelling up, Secretary. I see him down there, who, after all, was Education Secretary for 4 years, said you could scarcely find a better way of ending burning injustices than scrapping these handouts. Yeah, yeah. And here's why, and he talks about driving up standards. Just down the road in Southampton, and he'll know this, 4 in every 10 pupils fail their English or maths GCSE this year. 4 in 10. Is that £6 million of taxpayers' money better spent on rifle ranges in Winchester or driving up standards in Southampton?
Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, he talks about school standards. It's under a Conservative government, and thanks to the reforms of the former Education Secretary, that now almost 90% of schools are good or outstanding. But Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker, whenever he attacks me about where I went to school, he is attacking the hard-working aspiration of millions of people in this country. He's attacking people like my parents, Mr. Speaker. This is a country that believes in opportunity, not resentment. He doesn't understand that, and that's why he's not fit to lead.
Rishi Sunak there batting away Keir Starmer's question without actually answering it, which is a common theme of Prime Minister's questions. It's not really any big surprise it's not really any big surprise that we have seen the Prime Minister not particularly answer the question, but I do think it was one of the worse displays from Keir Starmer that we have seen at Prime Minister's Question since he became leader of the opposition, quite easily having his questions rebuffed all of the questions needed no real manoeuvring from any sort of position from the Prime Minister in order to turn them from attack questions right into nice, easy, G-up-the-backbenchers questions. Yes, we've seen that the Leader of the Opposition is adamant on questioning over private schools, Winchester College having a rowing club, rifle club, an art collection, charged £45,000 a year in fees, and got £6 million of taxpayers' money. All true. All things that could be justified as an attack line. But then going on to not really hammer home in any follow-up questions. It's a great opening to Prime Minister's questions from Keir Starmer. I suppose this is why I'm coming down quite harshly on his performance today. Because he didn't really follow up on what was quite a good opening line. But didn't really go anywhere after that. And this is not to say that there isn't something justified here in these attacks from Keir Starmer, saying why are private schools eligible for tax relief under a charitable status? It's a very legitimate question. Why are they eligible for such a large swath of taxpayers' money, essentially? And even if you don't see it as handing out taxpayers' money, it's certainly not providing anything. In Scotland, they've already made this change. Because private schools get their charitable status in England and Wales, they can get an 80% relief on business rates, at a minimum sometimes. But Scotland removed that discount in April. Now, these are big questions. These are really big issues, especially when you hear things being said by the Chancellor, who wasn't in his usual positions, right next to the Prime Minister at PMQs. Wonder why. Instead, he was flanked by the Deputy Prime Minister and, I believe, the Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, Kemi Badenoch. I always forget which way around it is because Ms. Badenoch has cajoled journalists for getting it wrong in the past. So I don't want to be one of those because I'm sure she's listening. And I'm sure the entire government is listening to this sort of area of conversation. But I tell you what, if you're listening and you want to make your voice heard, here's what you can do.
Express yourself with Expression Hotline.
Call Expression.
Call 01392-723568. Tell us what you want to hear. We might even get your voice on the airwaves. So pick up the phone and get ringing.
There we go. Express yourself with Expression Hotline. 01392-723-568 is the number to call to get your voice on the airwaves. If you've got things to say about charitable status, if you've got things to say about Le Camenab, oh, I've butchered that name again, but this new potential wonder drug for Alzheimer's. If you've got anything to say about our other stories as we go through and cover them throughout the show. One person I was surprised to see at Prime Minister's Questions was Sir Paul Beresford, who is the Member of Parliament for Mole Valley. And you couldn't make this up. For a man who is often called and sort of cajoled into being called part-time Paul, and I mean, it's not exactly a bad nickname. It's not exactly incorrect. It really is quite a fitting nickname for the member for Mole Valley, which is my home constituency. So I hope I know a little bit about this. Sir Paul Beresford standing up and saying, "I've just got back from the South Pacific," which was greeted with sort of laughter on a scale I haven't heard since the Liz Truss government. I'm joking. A shoddy piece of political humour there, but Sir Paul Beresford opening up on how he's just returned from a visit to the South Pacific, one of many, I'm sure, this year, Sir Paul. But he says the people in that part of the world are worried about the geopolitical threat that is China. And will Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, sort of clamp down on the Chinese state? Now, this is a very interesting question because we've seen recently China undergoing a bit of turmoil. Premier Xi Jinping, elected to his third consecutive term recently at the Chinese Communist Party conference. And then, curiously enough, there are protests, anti-COVID protests, in many Chinese cities, which saw people holding up blank signs in opposition to state censorship. And we've seen people arrested, a BBC journalist covering the unrest, arrested and beaten by Chinese state police. So Rishi Sunak saying that China is a country with fundamentally different values to the United Kingdom. He has said that the UK is taking steps to remove Chinese investment in both Welsh computer chip manufacturers and in British nuclear power, two of the ideas that he cited. Rishi Sunak has also said that the golden age of British-Chinese relations is over. There we go. A pretty definitive answer from Rishi Sunak. One of the few questions he didn't really answer it because he didn't actually answer the question that Sir Paul Beresford asked. Sir Paul Beresford, I believe, consistently rated one of the most loyal members of Parliament, or one of the most loyal Conservative members of Parliament anyway. As sort of every Conservative leader comes and goes. But talking about China, Jiang Zemin, who is the former Chinese president coming to power after the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests, has died aged 96. Let's have a little bit of a talk about that. Mr. Zhang made general secretary of the CCP, Chinese Communist Party, in 1989. He went on to serve as president for 4 years for 10 years, rather. I read that wrong. Between 1993 and 2003. It is a death from reportedly leukemia and multiple organ failure in Shanghai. But he sort of stepped down as party leader in 2002, remained head of the military for another year, and really was still quite an influential figure in Chinese politics. He was present at the CCP's conference in 2017, sat just to the side of Xi Jinping. So he is really a sort of paramount figure in the Chinese Communist Party. In his 13 years as General Secretary of the Party, Jiang Zemin guided the country's rise, it says here on Sky News, to economic power. He welcomed capitalists into the ruling party and pulled in foreign investment. He was premier during the Asian financial crisis and pulled in foreign investment after joining the World Trade Organization in 2001 and secured the bid to host the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing. So he has done a lot on the world stage for China. He also was the premier when Hong Kong was returned to China after 150 years of British rule. And in a letter to the Chinese people from the ruling Chinese Communist Party, which announced the death, it described him as as an incalculable loss and the death of a beloved comrade, outstanding leader of high prestige, and great Marxist. Now, the parallels here are, well, sort of stark, really, because we are now seeing the death of the Chinese premier who came to power after the Tiananmen Square protests, and now we are seeing how, as dissent in China is rising, and we are seeing crackdowns on, this dissent currently, Jiang Zemin has died. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is linked, but it is a narrative arc that you can see. Jiang Zemin has been one of the most sort of visible Chinese leaders in terms of political strength, not necessarily public awareness, because I think I wouldn't have been able to name him, certainly, had this name not been in front of me, or had someone said, go on, name the Chinese premiers. I think you would have got Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, and Xi Jinping. And I think for the majority of people, that is very much how it is. But in terms of as a political deal maker and someone strengthening China's soft power, he was meteoric. He travelled to the United States to meet Bill Clinton in 1997. He met George W. Bush at his ranch in Texas in 2002. He tried to get Queen Elizabeth II to sing karaoke on a visit to Britain. He enjoyed playing the piano and singing. He was really I don't know how we'll be able to sort of calculate the loss of this on China's soft power, especially as we're now seeing this Sino-opposed sentiment from around the world, and with good reason. This growing power of China is worrisome to many people, especially in neighbouring countries, but also in close economic competitors. This is going to be a very interesting time for China, and it's going to be noticeable if they fail to weather the storm. So this is certainly something that, deserves a longer look at on a separate episode when I've had a little bit more time to have a deep dive into the Chinese state. Probably get myself blacklisted on all of these BBC sites as well in the time, or wherever I'm wherever I am looking for these facts and figures. But it is definitely worthwhile having an explore and an exploration into this issue around China, and just having the death of Jiang Zemin as a starting point is sort of poetic in its harsh irony. Harsh irony. Now, let's have a look at something else that is, not always the easiest to talk about. We'll talk about Nigel Farage, the former leader of the UK Independence Party, UKIP, and then Reform UK, has been on Twitter talking about, I'll let you have a sort of listen for yourself. Because, Nigel,
the Office of National Statistics figures are out today, showing that London, Birmingham and Manchester are all now minority white cities. Massive, massive demographic changes taking place in our country. More significantly for the country as a whole, it shows that only 46% now identify as Christian. So there is a massive change in the identity of this country that is taking place through immigration. You may think it's a good thing, you may think it's a bad thing, but here's the real point of this. The ONS now say in future they will not ask of the nationality or birthplace of those taking part in this census. One in six in England and Wales already born outside the UK. In future, they want to hide the true figures from you. That's the real standout from these numbers today. It's a scandal.
Nigel Farage sort of railing against the ONS there, railing against these figures. It is interesting to have a look, because I'm going to go back to this, the ONS statistics. Two of those statements are factually inaccurate, definitively factually inaccurate. Manchester and London, two of the cities which he identified as being minority white in their census data reports, he is incorrect. Manchester, in the 2021 census, identified itself as 57% white, and London as 54% white. So those are just factual inaccuracies of a level surprising even for Nigel Farage, because it's not exactly hard to look at that data and say, well, actually, no, it doesn't show that. Now, the one in which he has a point is Birmingham, which has come forward in this new census data as being 49% white. Now, this is, again, factually, it marries up with what Nigel Farage is saying, but the implications behind what Nigel Farage is saying, by drawing attention to it in such stark contrast and in such harsh language, it's very, very worrying, because he also sort of, does have a bit of a reputation for dog whistle and sort of race baiting politics. Now, these figures released by the ONS yesterday from the 2021 census are part of a wider picture. 81.7% of the residents in England and Wales identified their ethnic group as white, a decrease of 4.3% from the 2011 census. It's still more people, 48.2 million to 48.7 million in 2021, of the usual residents of England and Wales identifying as white. And as part of the white ethnic group, 74.4% That's 44.4 million identified themselves as English, Welsh, Scottish, Northern Irish, or British. So white British. Now, this is just data at the end of the day. There's not going to be any real story or sort of scandal in here. It's not as if this is going to tell us precisely how many people crossed a border illegally, as Nigel Farage has been so at pains to bring to the public consciousness, sort of rubbing his hands with glee from his dinghy in Dover. But it does provide a key sort of element here of public analysis. Now, the biggest rise in any one group is the white other. So people not identifying as Irish, Gypsy or Irish traveller, Roma or white British, but just white brackets other for an ethnic group. So read into that what you will. That went from about 4.5% to 6.2% there. But it, on its own, this information is certainly not enough to be making these large-scale claims that Nigel Farage has been making. He is wrong in most of these claims. Now, he may be right in saying that the numbers are declining somewhat, but that is not a majority or minority white or non-white city. See, he is completely inaccurate in that statement. There are some local authorities in London with below 50% identifying as white. Newham, Brent, Redbridge, Harrow, Tower Hamlets, Ealing, Hounslow, Barking and Dagenham, Hillingdon and Croydon. But here we are saying again that it is possible to be both black and British. That should not be a new question, which seems to be an implicit link that Nigel Farage is making, that it is somewhat impossible to hold a duality. Now, I wonder where his disdain for sort of Polish and Romanian Labour has gone now, because he's lumping them into the white category alongside sort of good, strong British nationals, as he would have said back in 2013 and 2014. So this sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? This cognitive dissonance on the part, of Nigel Farage is stark, and it is really odd to see, because he is so wrong in some of the factual claims, which is just a nice easy thing to say by looking at this figure. You can say what numbers say. There we go. It's quite simple. He also said that there is a big religious change on the way here. Only 46% now identify as Christian. And he labelled that sort of a change to our culture caused by immigration. Now, I'm going to break his little heart here and say that Christianity coming to the United Kingdom, as was, or England, as it was a result of, wait for it, drumroll please, immigration. Yes, bonus points if you can tell me who it was that brought Christianity to the United Kingdom, or the constituent parts, as was during history. But Christianity did not originate in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, or the constituting territories that make it up. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise that Christianity was imported. Most things in Britain have been imported. Also, I do want to say, I answered that census question. I answered the question in relation to religion. I put no religion. I'm not an immigrant. I was born in Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. I've moved around down to Surrey. You could hardly accuse me of being an immigrant. They don't really get more home counties, for want of a better identifying phrase. And I'm not Christian. I wouldn't say that immigration has made me not a Christian. I would say that having a look at what I believe to be the established facts makes me not a Christian. There are plenty of things that you can say, maybe not a Christian, a wider reading in the world, a full and frank analysis from the point of view of myself about how things are changing and the necessity of a religious point. But none of that has anything to do with immigration. So Nigel Farage, talking guff. He also ends his sort of video with saying, the ONS now say in future they will not ask the nationality or the birthplace of those taking part in the census. In future, they want to hide the true figures from you. It's a scandal. Here's a statement from the ONS, the BBC's reality check. These claims are simply not true. We published the latest country of birth statistics from the census earlier this month and our latest migration estimates next week. We are reviewing the best methods to produce estimates of the UK population as part of our transformation of population and migration statistics, making the best use of all available data. By using new methods, we intend to produce our next estimates of the non-UK-born population in 2023. So this is a case of Nigel Farage technically perhaps being correct, because the ONS may choose to amend the census questions to not ask the nationality or birthplace of those taking part in the census. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop collecting the data. We have this census every 10 years as well, which is, let me think, 9 years away in 2031, which is when the next census is scheduled. So the sort of the ways in which this census is going to be collected just simply haven't been calculated yet. We don't know what questions they're going to ask, because you don't ask, or you don't devise the questions for a census 9 years before you ask them. In the same way that when a group of people band together and all put Jedi as their religion, that wasn't explicitly organised. It was just a load of people coming together and saying, yeah, you know what, let's do this instead. So, Nigel Farage, he is still a large player in British politics. There really is very little doubt. He does control the sway of sort of a large portion of the right-wing media narrative. But that doesn't make him right, which is rather important to mention. It's quite simply another element of Nigel Farage's character. He does always want to be in the headlines. He wants to be drumming up listeners or viewers for his show on GB News. Yeah, there we are. I don't know. This is quite simply another set of Nigel Farage talking and hoping people listen. And in a way, I'm quite pleased it happened on Twitter, because that platform seems to be dying. It really does. It's very much falling away. So let's play a nice sort of a really happy song. Let's pick a really, really happy song. Where can we find one? I wonder. Could it be about a brilliant time of the year? Could it be about one of those? Because what's a brilliant time of the year? Oh yeah, perhaps the most wonderful time of the year. Andy Williams, take it away. Suddenly I See by KT Tunstall. And before that, a rather cheeky little advert for my Sunday show, The Sunday Digest. Catch it between the hours of 9 and 10 p.m. on Expression FM. Obviously before that, the most wonderful time of the year, or it's the most wonderful time of the year, pardon me, from Andy Williams. That song released in 1968. Well. Let's see, where can we go with our next segment of the show? Because, yes, we've talked about Nigel Farage being wrong. We've talked about the Prime Minister answering, or rather not answering, a couple of questions. Happy St. Andrew's Day, by the way, whilst it dawns on me. Ian Blackford doing a good job of raising Scottish issues again. Also, kickoff in the Tunisia, France and Australia, Denmark matches. Both games live on the BBC. But you know what? Turn the pictures on. Just keep your sound tuned to Expression FM. There we go. You see, I knew we could come to an amicable solution. I'll keep you updated with the scores as and when they go in. I think anyway. May as well. I'm on the air. 0-0 between Australia and Denmark. 0-0 between Tunisia and France. The sort of group dynamic, well, France are through, but it's a three-way battle for second place. Australia on 3 points, Denmark on 1 point, Tunisia on 1 point. But as it stands, Australia on 4 points, Denmark on 2 points, Tunisia on 2 points. Because, of course, everyone getting that extra point for drawing today. So there needs to be a Denmark beating Australia and France beating Tunisia for Denmark to go through. And, well, if Australia win, they're through. Destiny in their own hands for the Socceroos. What a brilliant nickname, by the way. The Socceroos. Fantastic nickname. And like I said, very tight in Group C. Those games kicking off at 7 p.m. today. Poland top on 4 points. Argentina second, 3 points. Saudi Arabia also 3 points. Mexico 1 point. Bottom of the group so far. But they play Saudi Arabia, whereas Argentina play Poland. So it's still very much all to play for. We could still realistically see Mexico and Argentina going through. The only combination we can't have going through, really, at the moment, is Mexico and Saudi Arabia. God, that'd be a story if Saudi Arabia get through. Maybe they should have hosted the World Cup over Qatar. Anyway, I shouldn't get into that, because it'll just derail me. It'll derail me from how this is going to go. But let's talk about Buckingham Palace, and we're going to talk about an aide in Buckingham Palace who has resigned. Now, I don't believe that this aide has been named. There we are. No, no one has named the royal aide believed to be involved. But Ngozi Fulani, the head of a domestic abuse charity, was questioned where in Africa she was really from. Now, Miss Fulani is black, but is black British. Miss Fulani is also the founder of a London-based charity, Sister Space, S-I-S-T-A-H, which supports women of Afro-Caribbean heritage across the UK who face domestic and sexual abuse. And she was invited, along with 300 guests, to a very high-profile reception on Tuesday, where the Queen Consort, Camilla, warned of what is being labelled a global pandemic of violence against women. But after the event, Miss Fulani described this conversation on Twitter, where she was asked by a royal aide to explain where she was from. She replied, Hackney. The aide replied, no, what part of Africa are you from? She said, I don't know, they didn't leave any records. And the palace member responded, well, you must know where you're from. I spent time in France. Where are you from? To which Miss Fulani replied, here, the UK. No, but what nationality are you? I'm born here and I'm British. No, but where do you really come from? Where do your people come from? I feel like I had to read that whole thing out, because I kept saying, oh, no, no. In my head, I was going, oh, no, I'll stop off this line. Surely it'll got the point across. But no, this whole sort of jaw-dropping, stunning exchange. Members of the royal household have been circulating at the reception, making chit-chat. But this is intense and insistent questioning about someone's background. And it's, there's no place for it. Also part of the conversation, Ms. Reid, the leader of the Women's Equality Party, who's backed up this this account from Ms. Fulani. And this is really shocking to me, because we just don't see this sort of thing break out into the open very often. I have no doubt that it appears behind closed doors, and certainly to occur as a member of the royal household, where you are representing the most famous family in the world, probably. The Queen at the time of her death was probably the most famous person in the world. Maybe there are a couple of people who can sort of counter that, but certainly this is a place where you are walking on eggshells, but by design, because you are there to represent the best of British. That is part of the reason of having a royal family, is it not? I don't know. This is sort of very offensive. There's no doubt about that. And it is quite right that the palace member has resigned, because there is no place for them in representing the king and queen consort. There is no place for them in the whole sort of institution of British infrastructure, really. There is no place there. Now, I understand completely why this aide is not being named. I wouldn't think naming the aide is required at all. But just making sure that this never happens again, surely is of the most paramount importance. It really is sort of astounding to me that it could even happen in the first place. I am shocked, but I'm glad that it is being treated seriously. I'm glad that it is being dealt with, I'm assuming, at a very high level, given that it occurred at an event hosted by the Queen Consort. I would imagine there is a great deal of personal, not only embarrassment, but anger that this event has been sort of besmirched by this allegation and this subsequent action that has had to have been taken. But I'm very glad that it is being dealt with. Let's move on to another story now.
Traffic and travel.
And I wonder what we'll be talking about. Oh yeah, traffic and travel. RMT are going on strike. The Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union are bringing their members out in strike, and new to this particular sort of look through, the RMT has already announced strikes on Network Rail and 14 different train companies December 13th, 14th, 16th, 17th, and then January the 3rd, 4th, 6th and 7th. In association with ASLEH, the Train Drivers Union, which has staged walkouts in disputes over pay, they're not currently going out on strike or calling their members yet. But in a change to normal sort of working, or who normally goes on strike, as I fade away this bit of Chris Rea, it was requested. There we go. You know your requests can make it onto the airwaves. But security staff, rather, who work on the Eurostar train service, are to strike 4 days in the run-up to Christmas in a dispute over pay. Walkouts plan to take place on the 16th, 18th, 22nd and 23rd of December. The RMT, who are, well, members of the RMT, are employed by a private contractor on this. And they voted overwhelmingly in favour of the action to take a strike on those 4 days. More than 100 security staff employed by a company MITIE, are due to walk out, with RMT General Secretary Mick Lynch, who is a name and a face with which you must have become quite familiar. Have said security staff are essential to the running of the Eurostar, and it is disgraceful they are not being paid a decent wage. So this is going to be very disruptive, you would imagine, to the Eurostar. Those security workers work not just on sort of ticket collection, but they're in revenue and loss prevention sort of things, and they also make sure that unruly passengers are ejected from the Eurostar, hopefully not at speed. That's all I can say. And I'm sure they work with the utmost professionalism. But it certainly is going to be a bit of a blow to the Eurostar. And I wonder whether this will have the action that they need for the members of the RMT to not go on strike again. I personally don't think it will. We've already seen in the United Kingdom the RMT have been on strike on a number of different occasions. And it doesn't look like the government have sort of sat down to deal with the issues. And certainly they haven't done so satisfactorily in the opinion of the RMT, because they are continually going out on strike, which, yes, is being very disruptive and is annoying to some consumers, but is also the will of the RMT members, and would be sort of wrong of the General Secretary not to push through there. So people criticising Mick Lynch personally, saying, no, he can't be taking these people out on strike. Well, actually, he can, if it is the will of the members. And it is, demonstrably, has been so far, the will of his members. Inflation is running at more than 11% a year at the moment, and pay is just not catching up with it. And yes, what you may not agree with the action taken by the RMT, by ASLEF in the past, by the UCU, who were on strike again today. Between 8 and 12, there were UCU members on the picket line at the University of Exeter, UCU, the University and Colleges Union. But I don't think people can have realistically any arguments with what is in principle being asked for. Maybe the specifics we can have discussions about, but a wage that rises in line or close to in line with inflation, and that doesn't mean that over the course of maybe a four-year contract, you end up with a wage that in real terms is depreciating relative to the price of everything else, I don't think that is too controversial a topic. So, yes, this really is one that is, well, an argument that is going to continue all the way into the new year and probably beyond. And I don't think it will have a sort of satisfactory solution for a while. And I know that's rather sort of disappointing and disheartening, but it is something with which we will all have to sort of deal with and battle. So, yes, it's going to take a while to get this sorted. But hopefully it will be sorted. Let's have a look and see at some other stories. Because, yep, there are other stories going on. Let's talk banking. Let's talk money. Let's talk the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation. Anyone know what that is? Well, it's HSBC. Not many people know that's what it originally stood for, but HSBC is in the news today. It's going to close 114 more branches in the UK from April, with people saying, or rather HSBC saying, customers using them have fallen off significantly since the pandemic. HSBC operates at 441 branches in the United Kingdom. It's going to keep 327 of those UK branches open, but around 100 staff are going to lose their jobs. HSBC saying it will try its best to redeploy any staff at those 114 branches that are closing, but there we are, about 100 are going to lose their jobs. HSBC also going to be investing tens of millions of pounds in updating and improving the remaining 327 UK branches, but blaming online banking and sort of cutting costs for these lenders. So Jack Yui, who is the managing director of UK distribution at HSBC, has said people are changing. The way they bank and footfall in many branches is at an all-time low with no signs of it returning. Banking remotely is becoming the norm for the vast majority of us. Miss Yui saying closing a branch is never easy or taken lightly, especially if it's the last branch in an area. HSBC is investing heavily in post-closure measures. So they are providing free tablet devices to help some branch customers bank digitally, alongside coaching to help them migrate to digital banking. Now, I don't think anybody is saying that HSBC have to keep 114 banks open. But this is the sort of the speed of which these banks are disappearing is not really allowing for a smooth transition from in-person banking to online banking. HSBC said in March it plans to shut 69 branches by this autumn. Those have closed. But these new 114 branches, they're going soon. They're going really soon. And it's not just HSBC that are cutting banks. Since 2015, according to figures from the Which Consumer Group reported in the BBC, NatWest, which owns RBS and Ulster Bank, so seeing it all across the UK, has closed more than 1,200 branches. Lloyds Banking Group, which owns Halifax and Bank of Scotland, has closed more than 850 branches, with plans to close more than 70 additional branches in 2023, bringing them up to 920 in just 8 years. And Barclays, the individual bank that has shrunk the most, has closed more than 960 branches. Now, I can speak from a little bit of personal experience on this particular point, because my sort of hometown where I live outside of term time no longer has a bank. And I can say with a relative degree of certainty that a large proportion of the community who will not be sort of the most technically savvy members of the community, and I'm putting that quite kindly, there is a substantial proportion of the community who are older than the age wherein you would consider them to be naturally technically adept. Now, it's a broad generalisation, and I'm sure there are exceptions. But if you take away, first off, that community area, and second off, internet banking is absolutely no use if you can't access the internet. Now, in my area, internet access is relatively good. It's not one of the areas of the UK that is affected by shoddy internet connection, but there are areas of the UK that are. So there's no real way for some of these people, especially the elderly, who, and of course small businesses that bank in cash, which is the government's always been talking about how small and medium enterprises must be supported. Well, if the banks are closing, those small and medium enterprises will have to transition over to car payments only, and there's a fee on top of that. Post offices are still one alternative for paying in cash and cheques, but this move by HSBC looks like it's going to leave customers in rural areas frustrated, stuck, and unable to access their money. Tobias Gruber, CEO of loan broker My Community Finance, has said banks should take the money they save through closing branches to improve digital and telephone banking. He said, "It's unacceptable for bank customers to wait up to 30 minutes to speak to someone by telephone when it's their only choice because their local branch has vanished." Speaking of these local branches, let's go through, it's a long list, these branches that are going to be closing. But in April, HSBC are going to close their branches in Abergavenny, Alton, Bexhill-on-Sea, Blandford Forum, Bristol, Downend, Cromer, Lowminster, Market Bosworth, Shaftesbury, St Austell and St Ives. In May, branches in Arnold, Biddeford, Brecon, Bridport, Bridgehouse, Bristol Filton, Coleraine, Didcot, Dover, Dundee, Fakenham, Gainsborough, Helsowen, Hove, Launceston, Leicester at 11 Hinckley Road, Liskeard, Market Harborough, Minehead, Stamford, Stourport-on-Severn, Stroud, Sudbury, Waltham Cross, Whitby, Whitley Bay and Wilmslow will all lose their branches. And in June, Beccles, Bicester, Chepstow, Frome, Hartford, Honiton, Ilkley, Knutsford, Lewes, New Milton, Oakham, Penarth, Pocklington, Pontypool, Portadown, Ross-on-Wye, Skipton, Sleaford, South Shields, St Notts, Stirling, Twickenham, Wadebridge and Wells will all see no more HSBC signs outside their banks. That's a wide-ranging list there. We've got sort of Biddeford, home of our deputy station manager, losing its HSBC in the not-too-distant future. Honiton, just round the corner from where we are in Exeter here, also losing it. A couple in the south of Wales there, Pontypool and Penarth. South Shields, Skipton, Ross-on-Wye. Places all over Brecon in Brecon and Radnorshire, that famous by-election win, now without an HSBC from May. Abergavenny, it's all over the country, from sort of St Ives to South Shields, from St Ives to Stirling, in fact, and all the way from sort of across the country, north to south, east to west, people are losing their banks. And it's a real problem. It's not always the easiest for people to bank online. I find it frustrating anyway. But here we go. Things are changing. Things are moving along rapidly. And hopefully people aren't going to be left behind. Let's play a song. I've been waiting to play this song for a little while now, and this is a live rendition, a beautifully recorded live rendition, recorded for BBC Radio 2 by Rick Wakeman. Now, those of you who know him will know him, and those of you who don't will be thinking, who's Rick Wakeman? I'll tell you more about him after this song plays, but this is a very, very special rendition of Life on Mars. Life on Mars, recorded for BBC Radio 2 by Rick Wakeman, who I said I'd tell you a bit about him after, and he has had a sort of star-studded history without really being sort of one of the most famous names in the industry, best known for his sort of tenures in the prog rock band Yes between 1971 and 2004, and a couple of solo albums released in the 70s. You've really probably heard him more than you know. He quit his studies at the Royal College of Music, where he intended to be a concert pianist, in 1969 to become a full-time session musician, and he ended up playing on Space Oddity by David Bowie and other tracks that Bowie was on. I believe he was actually on the Life on Mars recording. And then he played on songs by Junior's Eyes, T-Rex, Cat Stevens, Elton John. He became a member of the Straubs in 1970, then joined Yes in 1971, playing on some of the most successful albums of Yes's discography. Yep, that is a word. It's always sort of been a rotating membership in Yes. He kept going away, coming back, going away, coming back again. But there have been some good songs coming out of that prog rock band. But then he released some great solo albums. The Six Wives of Henry VIII in 1973, Journey to the Centre of the Earth in 1974, The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table in 1975, all of them massive concept albums. He formed a rock band, the English Rock Ensemble, in 1974, and he continues to perform with them. There's a brilliant picture I've got here on my screen, in a sort of cape and sort of bejeweled cape, really, but Adidas trackies underneath it, sat behind a computer. He is a multi-talented, award-winning composer, pianist. He's scored a number of films. He doesn't just play the piano, though. He plays the grand piano, electric piano, pipe organ, Hammond organ, the Mini Moog, and later models of the synthesizer, the Mellotron as well, an analog electrical musical instrument using a bank of pre-recorded magnetic tape strips, and sort of played this on Space Oddity. He's also played it on a lot of his different tracks. There was an urban legend that said he got frustrated with a Mellotron and poured petrol on it and set fire to it, but it was debunked in 2010. but was then confirmed in 2016. Dun, dun, dun. sorry. He then developed the Birotron, which used 8-track cassette formats rather than tape strips. It was a Mellotron, but with cassettes, so two really outdated and antiquated bits of kit. What else about him? He's a Freemason since 2007. He is unique in the band, yes, as being a card-carrying conservative, and a really sort of multi-talented performer there. Rick Wakeman, and you could hear the love he has for piano playing in that little track. Right, let's have a look. Has there been any update in the World Cup? And I can tell you that the answer to that question is no. Australia 0, Denmark 0, Tunisia 0, France 0. Well, it's not exactly a bad thing. Keeping the games nice and tight until the end, so there's some great content by that point, hopefully. You never know. But I will, of course, let you know at some point if anything is to happen. Let's have a look at world news, because we've already talked about Zhang Zemin, the Chinese premier who has died at the age of 96. We've already talked about lecanemab, the Alzheimer's drug, hailed as this momentous breakthrough. A couple of really bad stories to bring to you. The first one comes from the Middle East, which is where we're actually going to stay for our first two stories. An Iranian man, Mehran Samak, has been shot and killed by security forces in northern Iran as anti-government protesters publicly celebrated the national football team's elimination from the World Cup. Activists have said Mr. Samak was shot in the head after he honked his car's horn in Bandar Anzali on Tuesday night. Many Iranians have refused to support their football team in Qatar, which obviously must come at a great personal sadness to the football team players, but is an important rite of protest against the Islamic Republic, which is what many Iranians see the IR Iran team, as it is called officially by FIFA, Islamic Republic of Iran, much like Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, KSA, when you see that little, sort of, where it's sort of squished together in its three-letter format. But many Iranians have refused to support their football team in Qatar. State-affiliated media have blamed hostile forces inside and outside Iran for putting unfair pressure on the players following their 1-0 loss to America in their final group game. The players did not sing the national anthem before their first game, which was a 6-2 defeat by England, and did sing the national anthem at both the Wales game and the United States of America's game. The team reportedly came under intense pressure from the Iranian authorities, but some protesters saw the singing of a national anthem as a betrayal of their cause. Now, this unrest has all been sparked sort of 10 weeks ago following the death in custody of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old woman arrested by the morality police in Tehran for allegedly violating the strict rules requiring women to cover their hair with a hijab. And authorities have responded to what they have been portraying as foreign-backed riots with a violent crackdown. The Norway-based group Iran Human Rights say at least 448 people have been killed, which number at least 60 children. More than 18,000 others have reportedly been arrested. Iran Human Rights reporting this death now of Mehran Samak, shot by security personnel in the Caspian Sea city of Bandar Anzali, celebrating the defeat of the Iranian football team. BBC Persian obtained a video showing Mr. Sanak's burial on Wednesday. Mourners at the burial have been heard chanting, "You are the filth, you are the immoral, I am a free woman." This is a protest chant used at the way of the morality police. So that is very much suggesting this was a protester, or somebody involved in these protests has been killed. Iranian security forces, however, reportedly deny killing any peaceful protesters. However, there are videos that say security forces are opening fire at people in the southwestern city of Behbahan overnight, beating a woman in Qazvin, south of Bandar Anzali. This is a politically inflamed situation, and it doesn't look likely to get any better soon. It really doesn't, unfortunately. We're going to move across a country in the Middle East now for our next story, which is a very sad one. At least 10 people have been killed after a bomb blast hit a religious school in northern Afghanistan, so says the ruling Taliban. The blast took place at Aibak in the Samangan province and left many more injured. A spokesperson for the Afghani Interior Ministry told the police. The death toll is currently uncertain, but two provincial officials have told the BBC 17 people died in the blast. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. This coming from Matt Murphy from BBC News. All of the victims are apparently children and ordinary people. Some patients with critical injuries have been transported to larger hospitals in Mazar-i-Sharif, which is about 74 miles away, which is quite a way. But it just shows that this is a real, it's a devastating situation that needs real intense scrutiny. No matter what people may think about the Taliban leadership, they don't have a history of false flag attacks when they are the ruling party. Aibak, a historic city, really, a trading hub from the 4th and 5th centuries, is about 200 kilometres north of Kabul. And it looks like this could be a blast rocking the Taliban leadership from ISIS-K, or the Islamic State Khorasan province. So this is a local offshoot of the Islamic State. This group is the most extreme of the militant groups in Afghanistan and has been targeting religious minorities, such as Hazaras, who the Taliban have pledged to protect. Hazaras, who are seemingly the main target of this particular attack. Interior Ministry spokesman Abdul Nafi Takur has said the Taliban security forces are investigating the attack and has vowed to identify the perpetrators and punish them for their actions. With the former president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, calling this explosion a crime against humanity in a tweet posted earlier today at about 1:45. The former president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, strongly condemns the explosion in the religious seminary in the provincial capital, due to which many of our countrymen were martyred and injured, and this terrorist act and crime against humanity, the work of enemies of the people and all human and Islamic values, calls the opposite action. The former president conveys his deep condolences and assurances to the families of the victims of this tragic incident and prays to the Almighty Allah for heaven for the martyrs and a speedy recovery for the injured. That tweet sent by his office on behalf of Hamid Karzai, the former president of Iran. So that we don't have too much more information on this. We know that the Taliban have blamed ISIS-K, again, Islamic State Khorasan province, for this attack. But the group itself haven't taken responsibility. And Human Rights Watch have stated that the Taliban authorities have done little to protect the communities from suicide bombings and other unlawful attacks. This seemingly another blast rocking a historic city, but one that is home to a significant religious minority. The Taliban's Afghanistan, not as safe as they promised, but I don't think that comes as too much of a surprise to the international community. One more story in the sad story categories, or in the worrying story categories. A Tokyo court has upheld a ban on same-sex marriage in Japan, but has also said that the ban was a violation of human rights. This is an interesting one. Japan, currently the only G7 nation that doesn't recognise same-sex marriage, was at the heart of a compensation case brought by four couples claiming Japan's ban on same-sex marriage was discriminatory. So campaigners, whilst having the ban on same-sex marriage upheld as constitutional, are calling this a fairly positive ruling. Or that's what Nobuhito Sawasaki, one of the lawyers involved in the case, has called it. Marriage remains between a man and a woman, according to this judgment. But according to Mr. Sawasaki, the court also said that the current situation with no legal protections is not good, suggesting something must be done about it. That comment going to Reuters. In today's ruling, the judge dismissed the case, but also said that blocking gay couples from a legal pathway to marriage was irrational. Now, Japan's constitution says that marriage is defined by the mutual consent of both sexes, which in the real world has very big consequences for same-sex couples who are not allowed to inherit each other's assets and denied parental rights to each other's children, and it can even cause difficulties for hospital visits. Both heterosexual and same-sex couples should be able to benefit equally from the system of marriage, as everyone is equal under the law, said Gon Matsunaka, the head of the activist group Marriage for All Japan. Hopes have been raised for a constitutional change to the law in 2021 when a court in the city of Sapporo declared the ban unconstitutional, but another decision in Osaka later upheld the ban. But this decision is significant because, as you might expect, Tokyo has a big influence on the rest of Japan. It's sort of like you see large state courts in America having then an influence over federal legal precedents. Not that you do see that very often, but if there was one, you'd imagine that a case that went through in Texas would have rather a larger pull on the national psyche and consciousness on how America would move forward than something happening in Rhode Island, for example. So there we have it, really. It is a difficult issue to talk about. Obviously, the US Senate has passed a same-sex marriage protection bill. Singapore has lifted a ban on gay sex, but also limited the prospects of legalizing marital unions. So this is a time of action, really, around homosexual rights in the world. Whether or not it is going to be positive, there is currently no sort of thought that Fumio Kishida's ruling party in Japan will have any plans to change or review the legislation, but several senior members of the party reportedly support same-sex marriage. So it could be a step in the right direction. Let's talk about a good news story. The French baguette. Yeah, an interesting one. But UNESCO have granted the French baguette World Heritage status. Yeah, the French baguette has genuinely got heritage status. I'm quite shocked. The country is said to produce about 16 million baguettes a day, and whilst the baguette has been in decline in recent years, with supermarkets struggling, supermarkets pushing away the market of traditional bakeries, there is something to celebrate for bakers and boulangers, as UNESCO has added the baguette to its intangible cultural heritage list. UNESCO has announced that it's added the artisanal know-how and culture of baguette bread to its list of items. There are around 600 items on this list, including traditional tea making in China and a Korean mask dance known as the talcum, both also included for the first time in 2022. According to UNESCO, this inclusion celebrates the French way of life, with Audrey Assoulay, the UNESCO chief, saying, "The baguette is a daily ritual, a structuring element of the meal, synonymous with sharing and conviviality. It is important that these skills and social habits continue to exist in the future." Well. Emmanuel Macron has also said the baguette is envied around the world. And I'm finding it rather hard to present this particular segment with a straight face, but genuinely, the baguette has just been given UN heritage status. I mean, pizza twirling has been given UNESCO heritage status. The pizzaiolo was given its status in 2017. Dear me. Oh, I'm sorry. This is quite funny. But yes, there are an amazing list of UNESCO World Heritage Sites. Jodrell Bank is on there, featuring in the famous Doctor Who episode, Logopolis, from 1981, Tom Baker's final ever episode as the scarf-wearing Time Lord. The Grand Canyon's on the UNESCO World Heritage Site. Plitvice Lakes National Park in Croatia. The Great Wall of China, of course, is on there. The city built into the side of a hill, Cinque Terre, in Italy. Five beautiful fishing villages that are on the side of cliffs, really. The Rila Monastery in Bulgaria, built in the 10th century and then restored after a fire between 1834 and 1862. That's the restoration, not the fire. That's on the list. Angkor, Cambodia, one of the most important archaeological sites in Southeast Asia, coming back from the 9th century. That's on the list. And now, of course, alongside Mont-Saint-Michel in France, you can add Le Baguette. Isn't Oh, dear me. It's funny. It's objectively funny, I'm sorry. There's nothing else to say about that. Let's just quickly talk about the World Cup, as France have gone into the halftime 0-0. Tunisia apparently have been on top. Three shots, two shots on target, opposed to two shots, no shots on target for the French. 0-0. In the other match, Australia and Denmark are also tied at no goals apiece. In this particular match, that has also gone to half-time. Honours even. Denmark have more of the ball, more shots, but fewer shots on target. It's going to be a close one. All to play for, remaining in Group D. And I'm sure, as I leave the airwaves, you'll be able to keep an even closer eye on how those games are going. Right, we've got 10 minutes left. So, as it's the final day of Movember, let's talk about Movember, which has been going on in Exeter and around the world. Movember, which started in Australia in 2003 as a result of two blokes, using two blokes is sort of a way to go for it, deciding to grow a mo to save a bro. That's the tagline that has been used by Movember for quite a while now. I've been sort of brewing up a little moustache on my top lip. It's not been particularly successful, but I guess it's there. It's an attempt. I'm not sure. I haven't been able to check how much money has been donated through into the Expression FM fundraising pot, but I will have a look. I will have a look and I will double check at some point later today. It's a very important sort of time of year. It sort of coincides with Men's Mental Health Month, and Movember itself has become Men's Mental Health Month. It's a time to raise money for charity. Movember itself didn't raise any money in its first year, but the year after raised thousands of pounds for the Prostate Cancer Foundation Australia, and has since gone global, with the University of Exeter raising over £500,000 recently since starting up fundraising efforts, I believe about 9 or so years ago. This year, the target is to beat last year's total, which I believe they are currently on track to do. I'll have a little look on their Exeter Movember page. I'm certain it's going to be on there, because they are very up and at it on Instagram, as I am. I'm not. You may or may not have noticed that the Politics Unboxed Instagram account has not been seeing the love recently, but it will be back up and running soon. Things have been a little bit stressful with some deadlines, but we're getting there. So Exeter Movember, let's have a look at their page. They haven't got any on there. They haven't got any stuff on there. Let's have a look. There was a message from Matt Dawson England's most caps scrum half, World Cup winner, Six Nations winning captain, giving a bit of encouragement to the Movember team, which obviously does have quite a large contingent of rugby boys. That's quite a large contingent of the University of Exeter, not going to lie. But let's have a quick look and see what I can find in the Exeter Mo space. So, Movember at Exeter has raised, pardon me, £98,051. So that is a very successful campaign so far. It's not as successful as last year, which raised £135,859. But there is still time. There is still plenty of time. There are plenty of ways that you can donate. Just go to Instagram, go to Exeter_Movember, and you'll be able to find all the links there on the page. It's very important as a way to try and fundraise for men's mental health, which is one of the key elements of fundraising here, as well as prostate cancer and testicular cancer awareness in the United Kingdom. So, Movember, nearly done and dusted. I'll be clean shaven again tomorrow. At least that's the plan, unless somebody can convince me otherwise. But that's the end of today's show, pretty much. There's not really any time to dive into another big ticket issue. There's not really too much time at all. There's only 5 minutes left in the show. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to thank you all very much for listening. And I'm going to play you out with a fabulous little song. A fabulous song from the Kinks. And it's a nice calming one to just sort of wind everybody down and make sure everyone's nice and ready for the end of the show and for the end of Movember. The end of November, it's the start of December. We've had some Christmas songs, so don't say I don't give you anything. We've had some Christmas songs. We've had some fun, and hopefully we will have some more fun the same time next week, because between the hours of 2 and 4 p.m., I'll be back on the airwaves to bring you Politics Unboxed as part of the Expression FM 1400 show. So thank you all very much for listening. Thank you to those of you who got in touch. Thank you to those of you who have just been listening and enjoying things, because to be honest, without you guys listening, it's just me talking to myself. So I thank you all for listening in and for tuning in. It is always appreciated. I very much hope you will join me at the same time next week or at 9 p.m. on Sunday. But for now, I'm going to leave you with the Kinks. This is Waterloo Sunset. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time.